A lion's head framed by a wreath of motion picture film, the trademark of Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer.
A clear night sky. Eight stars form a circle and spin round. A starburst changes them to the letter O of Orion. An Orion Pictures release. The film opens in woods near Quantico in the state of Virginia, with a backdrop of stark black trees silhouetted against a blue and grey morning sky. The film titles begin, black letters with a white shadow. A Strongheart Demi production. Jodie Foster, Anthony Hopkins, Scott Glenn. The Silence of the Lambs. A young woman is completing an assault course, climbing uphill through the woods, hauling herself up using a thick rope. The cast list continues. Ted Levine, Anthony Heald. The young woman has reached the top of her climb and now sets off running. In her 20s, with dark brown hair pulled back from her high cheekbone face, she's dressed in training shoes, black jogging pants and a grey jogging top bearing the insignia of the FBI Academy. Sweat is visible on the top as she runs on a carpet of wet leaves. Also in the cast, Brooke Smith, Diane Baker, Kazi Lemons, Charles Napier, Tracy Walter, Roger Corman, Ron Vorta, Danny Darst, Frankie Faison, Paul Lazar, Dan Butler, Chris Isaac. The girl has a determined look as she tackles a rope net obstacle.
Sterling! Sterling! Crawford wants to see you in his office.
Thank you, sir.
Starling leaves the message bearer, his basketball cap emblazoned with FBI in white letters. She passes a tree in which are pinned white boards, written on them, hurt, agony, pain, love it. Beneath, on darker wood, pride. Wiping the sweat from her face, she runs down a slope past two groups of runners coming in the opposite direction, and three tracksuited athletes climbing ropes on a steel frame, and she runs into a large, modern, geometric building. Further credits include the music by Howard Shaw. She's greeted by a fellow trainee.
Clarice.
Clasping her friend's hand, then releasing it, Clarice Starling walks briskly through the busy corridors, past a section where trainees in pale blue shirts and grey slacks are cleaning out the cartridge chambers of pistols. The film is based on the novel by Thomas Harris. Clarice enters an elevator, one woman among a group of nine men in red shirts and grey trousers. Emerging from the elevator, Clarice follows the signs marked Behavioral Science Services. On the blue painted stone walls, notice boards, which she glances at as she goes along. Ignoring other people in the corridor, Clarice stops outside a room in which two men are talking.
So there shouldn't be any problem if you could. You looking for Crawford?
Yes, sir.
Well, he should be back in a couple minutes. Why don't you wait in his office?
Okay.
And then, I think they were over in Flushing.
The titles continue with the producers, and then the director, Jonathan Demme. Clarice is now in Crawford's office. A large room full of tapes and files, with paintings and citations on the walls. As she slowly looks around, Clarice is transfixed by something she sees on one wall. huge notice board of photographs and newspaper articles, one headline standing out, Bill Skins Fifth. The photographs are mainly of girls' bodies with patches of raw red flesh where skin has been cut off, a whole arm, breasts, a back.
Starling. Clarice Inn. Good morning.
Morning, Mr. Crawford.
Sorry to pull you off the course at such short notice. Your instructors tell me you're doing well. Top quarter of your class.
I hope so. They haven't posted any grades yet.
A job's come up, and I thought about you. Not a job, really. More of an interesting errand. Sit down.
Yes, sir.
I remember you from my seminar at UVA. You grilled me pretty hard, as I recall, in the Bureau of Civil Rights record in the Hoover years. I gave you an A.
A minus, sir.
See, double major, psych and criminology, graduated magna, summer internships at the Reisinger Clinic. It says here, when you graduate, you want to come to work for me in behavioral science.
Yes, very much, sir. Very much.
We're interviewing all the serial killers now in custody for a psychobehavioral profile. Could be a real help in unsolved cases. Most of them have been happy to talk to us. You spook easily, Starling?
Not yet, sir.
See, the one we want most refuses to cooperate. I want you to go after him again today in the asylum.
Who's the subject?
The psychiatrist, Hannibal Lecter.
Hannibal the cannibal.
I don't expect him to talk to you. But I have to be able to say we tried. So if he won't cooperate, I want just straight reporting. How's he look? How's his cell look? Is he sketching, drawing? If he is, what's he sketching? Here's a dossier on Lecter. Copy of our questionnaire and a special ID for you. I have your memo on my desk by 0800 Wednesday.
Okay. Excuse me, sir, but why the urgency? Lecter's been in prison for so many years now. Is there some connection between him and Buffalo Bill, maybe?
I wish there were. I want your full attention, Starling.
Yes, sir.
Be very careful with Hannibal Lecter. Dr. Chilton at the asylum will go over all the physical procedures used with him. Do not deviate from them for any reason whatsoever. And you're to tell him nothing personal, Starling. Believe me, you don't want Hannibal Lecter inside your head. Just do your job, but never forget what he is.
And what is that?
Oh, he's a monster. Pure psychopath. So rare to capture one alive. From a research point of view, Lecter is our most prized asset.
Well.
You know, we get a lot of detectives here, but I must say I can't ever remember one as attractive. Will you be in Baltimore overnight? Because this can be quite a fun town if you have the right guide.
Well, I'm sure this is a great town, Dr. Chilton, but my instructions are to talk to Dr. Lecter and report back this afternoon.
I see. Well, let's make this quick, then. We've tried to study him, of course, but he's much too sophisticated for the standard tests. Oh, my, does he hate us? Thinks I'm his nemesis. Crawford's very clever, isn't he, using you?
What do you mean, sir?
Pretty young woman to turn him on. I don't believe Lecter's even seen a woman in 8 years. And, oh, are you ever his taste, so to speak?
I graduated from UVA, doctor. It is not a charm school.
Good, then you should be able to remember the rules. Do not touch the glass. Do not approach the glass. You pass him nothing but soft paper. No pencils or pens. No staples or paper clips in his paper. Use the sliding truth carrier. No exceptions. If he attempts to pass you anything, do not accept it. Do you understand me?
Yes, I understand, sir.
I'm going to show you why we insist on such precautions. On the afternoon of July 8, 1981, he complained of chest pains and was taken to the dispensary. His mouthpiece and restraints were removed for an EKG. When the nurse leaned over him, he did this to her.
Dr. Chilton shows her a photograph.
He's managed to reset her jaw, more or less, save one of her eyes. His pulse never got above 85, even when he ate her tongue. I keep him in here.
Dr. Chilton. If Lecter feels that you're his enemy, then, well, maybe we'll have more luck if I go in by myself. What do you think?
You might
have suggested this in my office and saved me the time.
Yes, sir. Then I would have missed the pleasure of your company, sir.
When she's finished, bring her out.
Smiling insincerely at Clarice, the flashily dressed doctor walks off, leaving a burly black attendant in white shirt, jacket, and trousers to escort her into a secure visitor's holding area, equipped with television monitors, in one of which she sees Chilton heading back upstairs to his office. Wheeling round, Clarice sees a bare brick cell, warning lights, another burly attendant, and then a third with a gun. The first one speaks.
I'm Barney. He told you, don't get near the glass.
Yes, he did, Clarice Starling.
Mm-hmm. Nice to meet you, Clarice. You can hang your coat up here if you like.
Oh, thank you, I will.
He's past the others. The last cell, you keep to the right. I put out a chair for you.
Oh, yes, that's very good, thank you.
I'll be watching. You'll do fine.
Bracing herself, Clarice moves forward. Cells are to her left. In the first, a friendly, smiling inmate in his 60s holding onto the bars. At the far end of the corridor, a lone chair. In the second cell, a morose man sitting by a table. In the third, an agitated inmate. Clarice heads for the chair placed in front of a cell with a glass panel in place of bars. Inside the cell, standing at attention, a man in his 50s with sleeked back hair.
Good morning.
Dr. Lecter, my name is Clarice Starling. May I speak with you?
You're one of Jack Crawford's, aren't you?
I am, yes.
May I see your credentials?
Certainly.
Clarice nervously removes her ID from her jacket pocket and holds it up next to her face.
Closer, please. Closer.
Clarice ventures forward, her ID stretched out in front of her. Lecter also steps towards the glass and, looking into her bright blue unflinching eyes, holds her gaze. He glances down at her ID.
That expires in 1 week. You're not real FBI, are you?
I'm still in training at the academy.
Jack Crawford sent a trainee to me.
Yes, I'm a student. I'm here to learn from you. Maybe you can decide for yourself whether or not I'm qualified enough to do that.
That is rather slippery of you, Agent Starling. Sit, please. Now then, tell me, what did Miggs say to you? Multiple Miggs in the next cell. He hissed at you. What did he say?
He said, I can smell your cunt.
I see. I myself cannot.
Lecter presses his nose towards the air holes in the glass.
You use Evian skin cream. And sometimes you wear lead at home. But not today.
Did you do all these wrongs, Doctor?
Ah. That is the Duomo scene from the Belvedere. You know Florence?
All that detail just from memory, sir?
Memory, Agent Starling, is what I have instead of a view.
Well, perhaps you'd care to lend us your view on this questionnaire, sir.
Oh, no. You were doing fine. You had been courteous and receptive to courtesy. You had established trust with the embarrassing truth about Miggs. And now this ham-handed segue into your questionnaire. It won't do.
I'm only asking you to look at this, Doctor. Either you will or you won't.
Yeah. Jack Crawford must be very busy indeed if he is recruiting help from the student body. Busy hunting that new one, Buffalo Bill. What a naughty boy he is. Do you know why he's called Buffalo Bill? Please tell me. The newspapers won't say.
Well, it started as a bad joke in Kansas City Homicide, and they said, this one likes to skin his humps.
Why do you think he removes their skins, Agent Starling? Throw me with your acumen.
It excites him. Most serial killers keep some sort of trophies from their victims.
I didn't.
No.
No, you ate yours.
You send that through now.
Clarice pushes the questionnaire in a drawer through to Lecter, then sits down. Leaning against the glass, he winks at her, licks his finger in a flamboyant fashion, and flicks through the document.
Oh, Agent Starling, you think you can dissect me with this blunt little tool?
No, I thought that your knowledge...
You're so ambitious, aren't you? Do you know what you look like to me with your good bag and your cheap shoes? You look like a rube. A well-scrubbed, hustling rube with a little taste. Good nutrition's given you some length of bone, but you're not more than one generation from poor white trash, are you, Agent Starling? And that accent you've tried so desperately to shed, pure West Virginia. What is your father dear? Is he a coal miner? Does he stink of the land? You know how quickly the boys found you, all those tedious, sticky fumblings in the back seats of cars, while you could only dream of getting out, getting anywhere, getting all the way to the FBI.
You see a lot, Doctor. When are you strong enough to point that high-powered perception at yourself? What about it? Why don't you look at yourself and write down what you see? Maybe you're frightened.
A census taker once tried to test me. I ate his liver with some fava beans and a nice Chianti. You fly back to school now, little Starling.
Clarice passes Mig's cell. He's lying naked, facing the wall, masturbating.
I bit my wrist so I could die. Look at the blood! Gotcha!
Mig! You stupid fuck!
Mig has thrown his semen at Clarice.
Agent Starling! Come back! Agent Starling! Agent Starling!
I would not have had that happen to you. This courtesy is unspeakably ugly to me.
Then do this test for me.
No, but I will make you happy. I'll give you a chance for what you love most.
And what is that, Doc?
Advancement, of course. Listen carefully. Look deep within yourself, Clarice Starling. Go seek out Miss Moffat, an old patient of mine. M-O-F-E-T. Go
Doctor.
Now. I don't think Mix could manage again quite so soon, even though he is crazy. Go now!
Having returned to Lecter, Clarice quickly makes her escape out of the bedroom, trying hard to retain her composure, but breaking into a run as the sliding door opens. Outside, she gulps down the fresh air. As she meanders back to her parked car, Clarice, with tears in her eyes, thinks back to her childhood and seeing her father, a town marshal, pulling up in the front drive of the house, and her watching him from the wooden porch.
Hey, Bill.
She recalls trying to creep up on him.
Daddy!
Hey, Clarice. Come over here.
Did you get any bad guys today, Daddy?
No, Angel, they all got away.
She remembers the beautiful countryside and the friendliness of the people, and mourns. Academy training continues.
Hands up! Don't move!
Turn around! Hands behind your back. Thumbs up.
A gun is pointed at the back of Clarice's head.
You're dead, Starling.
Johnson, good job. Good entry, good commands. Starling, where's your danger area?
In the corner, sir.
Did you check the corner?
No, sir.
That's the reason you're dead.
30-109. Breaking doors or windows to enter or exit. Rule 404.
In the library, Clarice is running through microfilm of newspaper articles concerning Lecter. One reads renowned psychiatrist charged in murder. Another reports new horrors and of how he served his victims as gourmet meals to friends. There are photographs of Lecter and Crawford.
Phone. It's the guru.
Crawford? Yeah. Thanks, Ardelia.
Starling?
Sir?
Miggs is dead.
Dead? How?
The orderly heard Lecter whispering to him all afternoon and Miggs crying. They found him at bed check. He'd swallowed his own tongue.
Clarice's eyes are wide and staring.
Yeah, I'm still here, sir. I don't know how to feel about this.
You don't have to feel any way about it. Lecter did it to amuse himself. Look, I know it got ugly today, but he mentioned a name at the end, Moffat. Any follow-up on her?
Well, Lecter altered or destroyed most of his patients' histories prior to capture, so there's no record of anyone named Moffat, but, I thought the yourself reference was too hokey for Lecter, so I figured he's from Baltimore, and I looked in the phone book, and there's a yourself storage facility right outside of downtown Baltimore, sir.
Unit 35 was leased for 10 years, prepaid in full. The contract is in the name of a Miss Hester Moffat.
So nobody's been in here since 1980?
Not to my knowledge. Privacy is a great concern to my customers.
Yes, I won't disturb anything, I promise. I'll be out of here before you know it.
Can I help you?
Yes, actually, I can't. Stuck.
You could return tomorrow with my son.
What about him?
I would ask my driver to help you, but he detests physical labor.
Right. Well, you just stay here. I'll be back in 1 minute.
The gray-bearded old man, wearing a heavy coat, long scarf and bowler hat, watches as Clarice, wrapped up in a duffel coat, goes to her car, switches on the headlights, then looks in the boot. Returning to the locked unit with her jack, she slips it under the door and starts to work on it.
Stuck. Hand me that flashlight, sir.
The door has raised about 18 inches. Clarice lies on her back, and using the torch, she peers into the dark unit, then looks back up at the old man.
Oh. If this door should fall down or anything else, this is the number for our Baltimore field office. Now, they know that you're with me. You call them if anything should happen.
Yes, Miss.
Easing herself under the door, Clarice catches her knee, tearing her trousers and cutting into her flesh. Inside, she starts her inspection. Her torch spotlights a stuffed eagle, its eyes staring, its wings spread in flight. She turns to see Taylor's dummies lying on shelves, a stuffed crocodile down below them, and beyond that, an old-fashioned upright piano with a carved front, its lid open, the keys covered in dust. At the far end of this dark treasure trove, she sees an enormous American flag, its red and white stripes still vivid, covering a large object. Treading carefully, she moves towards the flag through the mountains of bric-a-brac. She sees a Rolls-Royce mascot jutting out from under the flag. She pulls up the flag. The interior of the old-fashioned Rolls is plush, with curtained windows and heavily padded upholstery. On the back seat, an elegantly dressed tailor's dummy, minus its head, wearing pearls, a fur and a silk evening dress. It's holding a long cigarette holder. Using a handkerchief, Clarice turns the pages of a scrapbook, stopping on hearing the unit door fall shut. Resuming her investigation of the inside of the Rolls, Clarice stares at something opposite the dummy and wrapped in a silk and lace cover. Timidly unveiling it, she finds a bell-domed jar containing the preserved but slightly decaying head of a man. She drives in the rain to the asylum.
Hester Moffat, the rest of me. Miss, the rest of me, meaning that you rented that garage?
Rising from a cross-legged position on the floor between a muted television set and Lecter's cell, Clarice looks in the drawer which has been opened from inside it. A neatly folded towel is lying in it. She strains her eyes to look into the darkness of the cell, but cannot see Lecter. Wetting her lips, she reaches for the towel and settles herself back down on the floor to dry her hair, wet from the rain.
Thank you.
Your bleeding has stopped.
How did you? It's nothing. It's just a scratch. Dr. Lecter, whose head is in that bottle?
Why don't you ask me about Buffalo Bill?
Do you know something about him?
I might if I saw the case file. You could get that for me.
Well, why don't we talk about Miss Moffat? You wanted me to find him.
His real name is Benjamin Raspail, a former patient of mine whose romantic attachments ran to, shall we say, the exotic. I did not kill him, I assure you, merely tucked him away very much as I found him after he'd missed three appointments.
If you didn't kill him, then who did, sir?
Who can say? Best thing for him, really. His therapy was going nowhere.
His dress, makeup. Raspail was a transvestite?
In life? Oh, no. Garden variety manic depressive. Tedious. Very tedious. No, just think of him as a kind of experiment. A fledgling killer's first effort at transformation. How did you feel when you saw him, Clarice?
Scared at first, then exhilarated.
Jack Crawford is helping your career, isn't he? Apparently he likes you and you like him too.
I never thought about it.
Do you think Jack Crawford wants you sexually? True, he is much older, but do you think he visualizes scenarios, exchanges, fucking you?
That doesn't interest me, Doctor. Frankly, it's the sort of thing that Miggs would say.
Not anymore.
Clarice recoils. The lights come on.
Thank you, Barney.
What happened to your drawings?
Punishment, you see, for Miggs. Just like that gospel program. When you leave, they'll turn the volume way up. Dr. Chilton does enjoy his petty torment.
Did you mean by transformation, Doctor?
Rising from his position, leaning against the bare stone wall at the back of a cell, Lecter crosses to the glass.
I've been in this room for 8 years now, Clarice. And I know they will never ever let me out while I'm alive. What I want is a view. I want a window where I can see a tree, or even water. I want to be in a federal institution far away from Dr. Chilton.
What did you mean by fledgling killer? Are you saying that he's killed again?
I'm offering you a psychological profile in Buffalo Bill based on the case evidence. I'll help you catch him, Clarice.
Eyes fixed on his face, Clarice slowly rises to her feet.
You know who he is, don't you? Tell me who decapitated your patient, Doctor.
All good things to those who wait. I've waited, Clarice, but how long can you and old Jackie boy wait? Our little Billy must already be searching for that next special lady.
That night in Memphis, Tennessee, a cheerful, round-faced girl in her late teens with long blonde curly hair is driving along singing to the music, looking happy. Watching her arrival at her block of apartments is a man wearing a leather mask, holes cut for the eyes. As she pulls up, he attaches to his mask, with his brown-stained fingertips, a pair of infrared night-sight binoculars. The man takes the binoculars from his eyes.
Hey, little cheaper.
Fetching her bag and groceries from the back seat, the well-built girl addresses the cat looking out of the first-floor window.
I'll be right there.
She notices a man in bomber jacket, jeans and baseball cap, one arm heavily bandaged, struggling to move a sofa into a van. She watches him repeatedly fail to lift it up one-handed.
Can I help you with that?
Would you?
Sure.
Thank you.
That's all right. You look kind of handicapped.
Yeah. I got it this far. I just can't get it up in the truck. So, yeah, scratch this.
Oh, okay.
Good. You can set it down. That's good. Get in the truck, and I want to push it all the way up to it. I really appreciate it. Thank you. Yeah. Thank you. Yeah,
is this good?
Yeah, that's great.
That's
great.
Okay.
Hey, are you about a size 14?
Sorry.
Having punched her semi-conscious, the blonde-haired man shuts the van doors from the inside, turns her over on the sofa, and reads the label on her dress. American size 14.
Good.
Cutting open her dress with scissors, he exposes her back and strokes it with a hand on which is tattooed the word love.
Oh, good. Good.
Throwing the girl's dress out of the van where it falls by the bag of groceries, the man drives off with the girl in the back, the cat watching forlornly from the upstairs window. Next morning in the academy gym...
Darling!
Outside.
Let's go.
Cindy, in the ring for Starling. Let's go.
Clarice and her instructor pass a training exercise going on.
Saddle up.
Pack your field gear. You're moving out. You go with Profi.
Where?
Found a girl's body down in West Virginia. Been in the water about a week. Looks like a Buffalo Bill type situation.
With Jack Crawford in a small plane over the murky river, winding its way through Clay County in West Virginia, Clarice starts reading an FBI file.
Keeps him alive for 3 days. We don't know why. There's no evidence of rape or physical abuse prior to death. All the mutilation you see there is post-mortem. Okay, 3 days. Then he shoots them, skins them, and dumps them. Each body in a different river. The water leaves us no trace evidence of any kind. That's Frederica Bimmel, the first one. Her body was the only one he took the trouble to weight down, so actually she was the third girl found. After her, he got lazy.
Okay, let's see.
Circles where the girls were abducted, arrows where their bodies were found. This new one today washed up here, Elk River, West Virginia.
Two state troopers in uniform are waiting at the airfield, along with a third man in plain clothes. He drives Crawford and Clarice. She's sitting in the back with a file.
Tell me what you see.
Oh, he's a white male. Serial killers tend to hunt within their own ethnic groups. He's not a drifter. He's got his own house somewhere, not an apartment.
Why?
What he does with them takes privacy. He's in his 30s or 40s. He's got real physical strength. Combined with an older man's self-control, he's cautious, precise, and he's never impulsive. He'll never stop.
Why not?
He's got a real taste for it now, and he's getting better at his work.
Not bad, Starling. Questions?
Yes, sir. You haven't mentioned anything about the information contained in my report or Dr. Lecter's offer, sir.
Considering it.
That's why you sent me in there, isn't it? To get his help on Buffalo Bill, sir?
Crawford stares coldly at her.
That was the case, and I just wish I was in on it, that's all.
If I'd sent you in there with an actual agenda, Lecter would have known it instantly. He would have toyed with you, then turned to stone.
As the car enters a tunnel, Clarice looks hurt, staring at the back of her mentor's head, his short, graying hair swept back at the sides. Led by the state trooper's car, they turn into the parking lot of a funeral home, a large white wooden building with people milling about the gardens. A trooper leads Clarice, Crawford, and the plainclothes man inside.
Excuse me, Sheriff Perkins. These are the FBI people.
Sheriff Perkins, Jack Crawford, FBI. Special Agent Terry, Agent Starling. We appreciate being invited to your jurisdiction.
I didn't call you. That was somebody from the state attorney's office. We'll extend you every courtesy, but right now,
Sheriff.
This type of sex crime has certain aspects I'd just as soon discuss in private. You know what I mean?
Crawford, with a throwaway glance, indicates Clarice to the sheriff. Clarice twitches, and the sheriff, after a look in her direction, leads Crawford and Special Agent Terry into another room, leaving Clarice with a room full of deputies. Under the scrutiny of all the uniformed detectives, Clarice shifts uncomfortably and puts down her case. Casting her eyes down to avoid their gazes and easing off her scarf, she goes to the half-open door. Peeping through the opening in the doorway, she sees a funeral service about to begin. Pushing open the door, she walks in through the anteroom, down towards the rows of people dressed in black. The casket at the front is open at the top to allow people to pay their last respects to the young man in it. Clarice walks slowly down the aisle. As she approaches the casket, Clarice recalls as a young girl walking up to her father's body in its coffin, looking down at her dead father, and kissing him.
Casket, fetch Dr. Eagles from the chapel.
Yes, sir. Starling, we're back here.
Tell Lamar to come on when he's finished playing his music.
Yeah, we'll be sending him that. I need a six-way link-up. Chicago, Detroit. What?
Crawford is on the phone in the crowded back room.
Excuse me. Excuse me, gentlemen, you officers and gentlemen, listen here now. There's things we need to do for her. I know that y'all brought her this far and that her folks would thank you if they could for your kindness and your sensitivity. But now, please, go on now, let us take care of her. Go on now. Thank you. Thank you.
Okay, good. Yeah, that's right. West Virginia. Elk River. Stand by for transmission.
Crawford smears a cream on his upper lip. Special Agent Terry, now wearing a plastic apron and gloves, catches the jar and also applies the blocking cream before passing it on to Clarice.
Doctor, Lamar, let's take a look at her.
The doctor and undertaker recoil at the stench, as do Crawford and Clarice, who steadies herself.
Okay, Starling.
Bill.
The undertaker looks up at her with surprise, and Crawford stares dispassionately as Clarice approaches the body. Leaning over to examine it, she prepares to speak into a recorder.
Star-shaped contact entrance wound over the sternum. Muzzle stamp at the top.
Wrongful death.
Wrongful death.
She'll have to go to the state pathologist at Claxton. Well, I better get back to that service. Lamar will help you. Lord Almighty. What else do you see, Starling?
Well, she's not local. Her ears are pierced three times, and there's a glitter nail polish. It looks like town to me.
Clarice closes her mouth tight, puffing out her upper lip. The doctor eyeing her keenly.
Her nails are broken off, and there's dirt or grit under them. It looks like she's tried to claw her way through something.
Ray, get pictures of her teeth. We'll fax them for missing persons.
Right.
Ray hands Clarice a Polaroid snap. She looks closely at the picture of the open mouth and blackened tongue.
She's got something in her throat.
When a body comes out of the water, lots of times there's like leaves and things in the mouth.
Taking a pair of metal forceps in his gloved hands, Ray moves towards the body. He leans over the mouth, which is being held open by Lamar. Using his left hand to hold the lower jaw, and with the forceps in his right hand, Ray probes inside the victim's mouth. The others look on. Eventually he locates what is stuck in the throat and extracts a bean-shaped object with a curved tentacle on top.
What is that? Some kind of seed pod?
No, sir. That's a bug cocoon. There's no way that could get way down in there like that.
Unless somebody shoved it in there.
She'll be easier to print when we turn her over. Lamar, will you give me a hand with this?
Yes, sir, I will.
Clarice pours formalin into the bottle holding the bug.
Oh, Jack. What do you make of these?
Different configuration than the other victims. Get close-ups.
Victim's skin removed, this time in two large diamond-shaped sections above the buttocks. Stellate exit wound level with the second or the third thoracic vertebrae, approximately 6 inches from the right shoulder blade.
Starling.
When I told that sheriff we shouldn't talk in front of a woman, that really burned you, didn't it?
It was just smoke, Starling. I had to get rid of him.
Matters, Mr. Crawford. Cops look at you to see how to act. Matters.
Point taken.
Ligature marks found around the wrists, not around the ankles. This would indicate that the skin was post-mortem.
In Washington's Natural History Museum, a guard shows Clarice into a large display room filled with the skeletons of prehistoric animals, which tower above her as she makes her way through it alone, unbuttoning her coat as she goes. From a gallery, she looks down on two men playing with a beetle on a chessboard.
Time tells you, my move.
No fair, you lured him with produce.
Tough noogies. Still my turn. Nice and slow, baby.
If the beetle moves one of your men, does that still count?
Of course it counts. How do you play?
Agent Starling?
Where the heck did this come from? It's practically mush.
It was found behind the soft pallet of a murder victim. The body was in the Elk River in West Virginia.
It's Buffalo Bill, isn't it?
I'm afraid I can't tell you any more about that.
We heard about it on the radio.
You mean this is like a clue from a real murder case? Cool.
Just ignore him. He's not a PhD.
A sphingid ceratomia, maybe. Boy, he's a big sucker. Okay, let's check morphology.
The bug is slit open, releasing a honey-like substance.
What do you do when you're not detecting, Agent Starling?
Try to be a student, Dr. Pilcher.
You ever go out for cheeseburgers and beer? The amusing house wine?
Are you hitting on me, Doctor?
Yes.
Gotcha.
What do you got, Roden?
Agent Starling, meet Mr. Acherontius Styx.
Weird.
Better known to his friends as the Death's Head Moth.
Now, where does it come from?
That's what's strange. Only live in Asia.
Asia?
In this country, they'd have to be specially raised from imported eggs.
Now, somebody grew this guy. Fed him honey and nightshade. Kept him warm. Somebody loved him.
A room full of butterflies, moths, caterpillars, and chrysalis in large glass cases and subdued blue lighting. In one corner, an aquarium. Beside it, a long flat metal trolley with a harness at one end. Laid out next to the trolley, a display of knives. Through a dingy corridor, another stone-walled room with tailor's mannequins in garish clothes. In the room, a naked man is working at a sewing machine. The cries are coming from a pit in the cellar.
Good morning, I'm Donna Faruqi.
I'm Gene Castle with sports.
And I'm Tim Langhorn. Our top story for this morning. Catherine Martin, the 25-year-old daughter of Senator Ruth Martin, listed first as a missing person, is now believed to have been kidnapped by the serial killer known only as Buffalo Bill. Memphis police sources indicate that the missing girl's blouse has been identified, sliced up the back, in what has become a kind of grim, all-too-familiar calling card. Young Catherine Martin, as we've said, is the only daughter of U.S. Senator Ruth Martin, the Republican junior senator from Tennessee. And while her kidnapping is not at this point considered to be politically motivated, nevertheless, it has stirred the government to its highest levels. Reach for comment on the ski slopes of Stowe, Vermont. The president himself said to be, and I quote, intensely concerned. Just moments ago, Senator Martin takes this dramatic personal plea.
I'm speaking now to the person who is holding my daughter. Catherine is very gentle and kind. Talk to her and you'll see. You have the power. You are in charge. I know you can feel love and compassion. You have a wonderful chance to show the whole world that you can be merciful as well as strong. That you're big enough to treat Catherine better than the world has treated you. You have that power. Please. My daughter is Catherine.
Boy, that's smart.
Release her unharmed.
Jesus, that's really smart.
Anywhere
she keeps
in the
repeating
country.
The name.
And I promise
she sees Catherine as a person and not just an object. It's harder to tear her up.
Please, release my little girl.
What you're doing, Miss Starling, is coming into my hospital to conduct an interview and refusing to share information with me for the third time.
Sir, I told you this is just a routine follow-up on the Raspell
case. He is my patient. I have rights.
I understand that, sir.
Look, I am not just some turnkey, Miss Starling.
This is the number for the U.S. Attorney's Office. Please, either you discuss this with him or you let me do my job. You understand?
Dr. Chilton purses his lips as if a thought had struck him.
Your profile helps us catch Buffalo Bill in time to save Catherine Martin. The senator promises you a transfer to the VA hospital at Oneida Park, New York, with a view of the woods nearby. Maximum security still applies, of course. You'd have reasonable access to books. Best of all, though, 1 week of the year, you get to leave the hospital and go here. Plum Island. Every day of that week, you may walk on the beach. You may swim in the ocean for up to 1 hour under SWAT team surveillance, of course. And there you have it. Copy of the Buffalo Bill case file. Copy of the senator's offer. This offer is non-negotiable and final. Catherine Martin dies, you get nothing.
Clarice keeps her eyes firmly on Lecter, who flexes his left hand before stretching to look at the paperwork in the drawer.
Plum Island Animal Disease Research Center. Sounds charming.
That's only part of the island. There's very, very nice beach. Tern's nest there. There's beautiful...
Tern's? If I help you, Clarice, it will be Tern's with us, too. Quid pro quo. I tell you things, you tell me things. Not about this case, though. About yourself. Quid pro quo. Yes or no? Yes or no, Clarice? Poor little Catherine is waiting.
Go, Doctor.
What is your worst memory of childhood?
Death of my father.
Tell me about it and don't lie, or I'll know.
He was a town marshal, and one night he surprised two burglars coming out of the back of a drugstore. They shot him.
Was he killed outright?
No, he was... very strong. He lasted more than a month. My mother died when I was very young, so my father had become the whole world to me. And when he left me, I had nothing. I was 10 years old.
You're very frank, Clarice. I think it would be quite something to know you in private life.
Quid pro quo, Doc.
So tell me about Miss West Virginia. Was she a large girl?
Yes.
Big through the hips, roomy?
They all were.
What else?
She had an object deliberately inserted into her throat. Now, that hasn't been made public yet. We don't know what it means.
Was it a butterfly?
Yes, a moth. Just like the one we found in Benjamin Raspail's head an hour ago. Why does he place them there, Doctor?
The significance of the moth is change. Caterpillar into chrysalis or pupa, and from thence into beauty. Our belly wants to change too.
There's no correlation in the literature between transsexualism and violence. Transsexuals are very passive.
Clever girl. You're so close to the way you're gonna catch him. Do you realize that?
No, tell me why.
After your father's murder, you were orphaned. What happened next? I don't imagine the answer is on those second-rate shoes, Clarice.
I went to live with my mother's cousin and her husband in Montana. They had a ranch.
Was it a cattle ranch?
Sheep and horses.
How long did you live there?
2 months.
Why so briefly?
I ran away.
Why, Clarice? Did the rancher make you perform fellatio? Did he sodomize you?
No. He was a very decent man. Quid pro quo, Doctor.
Billy is not a real transsexual, but he thinks he is. He tries to be. He's tried to be a lot of things, I expect.
Now, you said that I was very close to the way we would catch him. What did you mean, Doctor?
There are three major centers for transsexual surgery: Johns Hopkins, the University of Minnesota, and Columbus Medical Center. I wouldn't be surprised if Billy had applied for sex reassignment at one or all of them and been rejected.
On what basis would they reject him?
look for severe childhood disturbances associated with violence. Our Billy wasn't born a criminal, Clarice. He was made one through years of systematic abuse. Billy hates his own identity, you see, and he thinks that makes him a transsexual. But his pathology is 1,000 times more savage and more terrifying.
Chilton is recording the conversation at the pit.
On its skin, it does this whenever it's told.
Mister, my family will pay cash. Whatever ransom you're asking for, they'll pay it.
It rubs the lotion on its skin, or else it gets the hose again.
Yes, you will, precious. You will get the hose.
Okay. Mister, if you let me go, I won't press charges, I promise. See, my mom is a real important woman. I guess you already know that.
Now it places the lotion in the basket.
Please. I want to go home, please.
It places the lotion in the basket.
I want to see my mommy. Please, no.
Put the fucking lotion in the basket!
As the lamp in the basket rises, it illuminates the walls of the pit, covered in scratches, blood, and torn flesh. The tormentor mimics the terrified girl. Dr. Chilton is in Lecter's cell.
You're gonna walk on some beach and see the birdies? No, I don't think so. I called Senator Ruth Martin. She never heard of any deal with you. They scammed you, Hannibal. Stand outside. And shut the door.
Hannibal is strapped to an upright stretcher, a metal guard over his face. He spies Chilton's pen.
With Senator Martin, but there is now. I designed it. Of course, I worked in a few conditions for my own benefit as well. Identify Buffalo Bill by name. And if the girl is found in time, Senator Martin will have you transferred to Brushy Mountain State Prison, Tennessee. Answer me, Hannibal. You answer me now, or by God, you'll never leave this cell. Who is Buffalo Bill?
His first name is Lewis. I'll tell the rest of the senator herself, but only in Tennessee. And I have a few conditions of my own.
Clean him up and get him ready to go.
Jack, Hannibal Lecter is being transferred to Memphis.
Transferred?
Did you have a trainee make some sort of phony offer to Lecter in the senator's name?
Yeah, I rolled the dice. I had to.
Well, she's mad as hell, Jack. Paul Krenler's over here from Justice. She's asking him to take over in Memphis.
Memphis International Airport at night. Two cavalcades of police cars make their way to a hangar. Hannibal Lecter is wheeled in on a trolley. His arms in a straitjacket, he's strapped to the trolley. Over his nose and jaws a plastic face mask with air holes. Covering the open mouthpiece, three strips of metal.
Welcome to Memphis, Dr. Lecter. I'm Lieutenant Boyle. This is Sergeant Patrick. Now we're going to treat you as good as you treat us. You be a gentleman, you're going to get three hots to cot. Sir? Sign right here will have us a legal transfer.
Chilton, looking full of himself, can't find the pen he last had in Hannibal's cell. Hannibal's eyes are fixed on Chilton. From a stretched limousine at the far end of the hangar comes a well-dressed, well-coiffured woman in her early 50s with high cheekbones and sunken eyes, wearing a high-collared blouse and an unfastened overcoat over a grey suit. One of an entourage of bodyguards and advisors waves a hand towards the troop of policemen surrounding Lecter. They part, and Hannibal is wheeled towards the senator. She walks towards him, holding her hand up to stop her men following. Her lips are closed, her face taut, her eyes unwavering. Both groups come to a halt.
Senator Martin, Dr. Hannibal Lecter.
Hannibal is stood upright, still strapped to the trolley.
Dr. Lecter, I brought an affidavit guaranteeing your new rights. You want to read it before I sign.
I won't waste your time or Catherine's time bargaining for petty privileges. Clarice Starling and that awful Jack Crawford have wasted far too much time already. I only pray they haven't doomed the poor girl. Let me help you now, and I will trust you when it is all over.
You have my word, Paul.
Buffalo Bill's real name is Lewis Friend. I met him just once. He was referred to me in April or May 1980 by my patient Benjamin Raspel. They were lovers, you see. But Raspel had become very frightened. Apparently, Lewis had murdered a transient and done things with the skin.
We need his address and a physical description.
Tell me, Senator, did you nurse Catherine yourself?
What?
Did you breastfeed her?
Now, wait a minute.
Yes, I did.
Toughened your nipples, didn't it?
Oh, son of a bitch!
Amputate a man's leg and he can still feel it tickling. Tell me, Mom, when your little girl is on the slab, where will it tickle you?
Take this thing back to Baltimore.
5'10", strongly built, about 180 pounds. Hair blonde, eyes pale blue. He'd be about 35 now. He said he lived in Philadelphia, but may have lied. That's all I can remember, Mom. But if I think of any more, I will let you know. Oh, and Senator, just one more thing. Love your suit.
Outside Shelby County Courthouse.
Meeting earlier this evening with Senator Ruth Martin. Dr. Lecter agrees to assist in the investigation of trying to find the abductor of Catherine Martin, Buffalo Bill.
How do you think, sir?
Well, it's only through my own unique insight into Lecter's mind that this breakthrough was possible.
And Buffalo Bill's real name?
Buffalo Bill's real name is now a matter of record with the proper authorities.
Can you give us
my name is Dr. Frederick Chilton.
How do you spell that?
C-H.
Are you with Dr. Chilton's group?
Well, I just saw that size, sir.
Access to Lecter is strictly limited. We've been getting death threats.
I understand, sir.
Clarice, carrying a roll of poster papers, has sneaked past Chilton into the heavily guarded courthouse.
Well, I can't take all the credit for myself. Senator Martin, Justice Department, people at the FBI, the folks at the Baltimore State Hospital. And now for the hard part, apprehending the suspect. Excuse me, folks, I'm going to have to catch a flight.
Explain that.
Clarice hides her face from Crendler while she hands over her gun and spare cartridges. In the elevator, on the way up, she's working out the anagram of Lewis Friend when the young, spiky-haired officer with her quizzes her.
Is it true what they're saying?
Huh?
Some kind of vampire?
They don't have a name for it yet.
You do know the rules, ma'am?
Yes, Lieutenant Boyle. I've questioned him before.
Go ahead.
Taking her roll of papers back from Lieutenant Boyle, Clarice walks slowly across the highly polished wooden floor of the vast courtroom towards a large cage in the middle of the room. She nods to a second officer in the room who moves to join the lieutenant. Inside the cage, Lecter, in a T-shirt, is sitting behind a desk with his back to Clarice. He's reading a book held out in front of him. Clarice stops at a set of barriers placed in front of the cage. Hannibal reads on and then speaks without turning his head.
Good evening, Clarice.
I thought you might like your drawings back, Doctor. Just until you get your view.
How very thoughtful. Or did Jack Crawford send you for one last wheedle before you're both booted off the case?
No, I came because I wanted to.
People will say we're in love. Anthrax Island. That was an especially nice touch, Clarice. Yours? Yeah. That was good. Pity about poor Catherine, though. Tick-tock, 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 tick-tock.
Your anagrams are showing, Doctor. Lewis Friend. Iron sulfide, also known as Fool's Gold.
Oh, Clarice, your problem is you need to get more fun out of life.
You were telling me the truth back in Baltimore, sir. Please continue now.
Well, I've read the case files, have you? Everything you need to find him is right there in those pages.
And tell me how.
First principles, Clarice. Simplicity. Read Marcus Aurelius. Of each particular thing, ask, what is it in itself? What is its nature? What does he do, this man you seek?
He kills women.
No, that is incidental. What is the first and principal thing he does? What needs does he serve by killing?
Anger. Social acceptance and sexual frustrations.
No, he covets. That is his nature. And how do we begin to covet, Clarice? Do we seek out things to covet? Make an effort to answer now.
No. We just...
No. We begin by coveting what we see every day. Don't you feel eyes moving over your body, Clarice? And don't your eyes seek out the things you want?
All right, yes. Now please tell me how.
No. This is your turn to tell me, Clarice. You don't have any more vacations to sell. Why did you leave that ranch?
Doctor, we don't have any more time for any of this now.
But we don't reckon time the same way, do we, Clarice? This is all the time you'll ever have.
Later. Now, please, listen to me. We've only got five...
No. I will listen now. After your father's murder, you were orphaned. You were 10 years old. You went to live with cousins on a sheep and horse ranch in Montana. And?
And one morning, I just ran away.
Not just, Clarice. What set you off? You started at what time?
Early, still dark.
Then something woke you, didn't it? Was it a dream? What was it?
I heard a strange noise.
What was it?
It was... screaming. Some kind of screaming, like a child's voice.
What did you do?
I went downstairs, outside. I crept up into the barn. I was so scared to look inside, but I had to.
What did you see, Clarice? What did you see?
Lambs. They were screaming.
They were slaughtering the spring lambs?
And they were screaming.
And you ran away?
No. First I tried to free them. I opened the gate to their pen, but they wouldn't run. They just stood there.
But you could, and you did, didn't you?
Yes. I took one lamb and I ran away as fast as I could.
Where were you going, Clarice?
I don't know. I didn't have any food, any water, and it was very cold. Very cold. I thought if I could save just one, but he was so heavy. I didn't get more than a few miles when the sheriff's car picked me up. Rancher was so angry, he sent me to live at the Lutheran Orphanage in Postman. I never saw a ranch again.
What became of your lamb, Clarice?
I killed him.
You still wake up sometimes, don't you? You wake up in the dark and hear the screaming of the lamb. And you think if you save poor Catherine, you could make them stop, don't you? You think if Catherine lives, you won't wake up in the dark ever again to that awful screaming of the lambs.
I don't know. I don't know.
Thank you, Clary. Thank you.
Tell me his name, Doctor.
Sniffing the air, Lecter looks up to the ceiling.
I think you know each other.
Okay. Let's go.
It's your turn, Doctor.
Out.
Tommy's name.
Sorry, ma'am. I've got orders. I've put you on a plane. Come on now.
Brave Clarice. You will let me know when those lambs stop screaming, won't you?
Tell me his name, Doctor.
Clarice! Your case filed.
Breaking free, Clarice stretches for the file held out through the bars. The hands touch, and Lecter tenderly strokes Clarice's forefinger with his. She's dragged away by the two police officers and looks back forlornly at the cage as Chilton leads the way out. She flies out of Memphis. The night skyline of Washington, D.C., with the Washington Memorial and Capitol Building lit up. Clarice cuts a desolate figure as she strolls through the airport terminal, her bag in one hand, her coat over her arm. On Lecter's desk in the cage, a cassette player, a poetry booklet, and some artwork, including a sketch of Clarice holding a lamb in her arms. Hannibal himself is sitting behind a screen. The two policemen guarding him are walking across the polished floor, carrying a tray of food.
Ready when you are, Doc.
Just another minute, please.
Hannibal's hair is sleeked back. He is sitting, eyes closed, in a meditative pose.
Son of a bitch demanded a second dinner. Lamb chops, extra rare.
What he wants for breakfast. Damn thing, zoo.
The tray has been laid down outside the cage. The lieutenant hands his long-arm truncheon to his partner. Lecter, meanwhile, disgorges from his mouth the clip-on part of Chilton's pen. The lieutenant passes his disabling spray onto his partner, and they stand and wait till Lecter emerges from behind his screen, walking slowly towards them.
Good evening, gentlemen.
Okay, Doc, grab some flora.
Same drill as before, please.
Wedged between two of Hannibal's fingers is the pen clip. His back to the bars, Lecter slips his arms through. The sergeant moves a barrier and stands behind Hannibal, who is now sitting on the floor of the cage. The sergeant snaps handcuffs into place around Hannibal's wrists and pulls the interlocking chain to test its strength.
Okay.
Hannibal picks the locks of the handcuffs with the pen clip.
Hand me that one.
Unlocking the cage door, the lieutenant walks in, taking the tray.
Thanks.
Mind the drawings, please. Thank you.
The lieutenant searches around for somewhere other than the desktop to lay the tray and places it down beside Hannibal. Returning to the desk, he rolls up the drawings and tidies them away. Taking the key from the lock, the sergeant pays no attention to Boyle, who returns to the tray. As he reaches down for it, Hannibal swings a now free cuff around the lieutenant's wrist, fastening the other end of the cuffs to the bars. Hannibal kicks the metal bar door in the face of the sergeant and leaps on him, biting a chunk from his cheek. He slams the sergeant's head repeatedly on the bars of the cage, releases him, then sprays his eyes so he slips, blinded, to the floor. His mouth circled in blood, Hannibal turns to the handcuffed and helpless lieutenant. He raises the long truncheon high above his head. The lifeless body of the lieutenant is lying in a pool of blood on the floor of the cage, one hand still cuffed to the bars, the contents of his pockets and the long-handled truncheon beside him. The blood-spattered figure of Hannibal Lecter is standing, eyes closed, rhythmically swaying to the music coming from the cassette player. Hearing the groans, Hannibal's concentration is broken. He looks around the cell and sees the lieutenant's penknife lying by his body. Picking it up and checking its blade, He heads for the cage door.
Ready when you are, Sergeant Pembrey.
Hannibal walks out of the cage towards the fallen sergeant. In the lobby of the courtroom building, the elevator indicator moves.
Shit. Did somebody go up on 5?
No, nobody went up.
Call Pembrey, ask him to tell them. CP, shots fired on 5, repeat. Shots fired on 5.
Sergeant Tate!
Holy shit.
The hell? Sorry, bitch.
Shut up. Bobby, get the vest.
Right, Sarge.
Brainy, Howard, cover the...
Look!
The indicator stops at the third floor.
Seal off a 10-block radius. Give me the SWAT team and an ambulance, double quick. We're going up.
Led by the sergeant, a squad of 5 armed officers make their way up the stairs to the third floor, each covering the other as they leapfrog past one another, sweat pouring down their faces. Once at the third level, they ease along the corridor towards the open elevator, making intricate patterns as they crisscross from side to side for protection. Reaching the elevator, they find it empty.
Pembrey! Oh!
Moving up to the fifth floor, they burst into the courtroom.
God.
Lieutenant Boyle is crucified on the cage bars, his stomach cut open, his insides removed. Running past Pembrey lying on the floor, the officers check the room. The spiky-haired Bobby kneels by Pembrey.
Command post. 2 officers down.
Clear!
Lecter's gone, Sarge.
Prisoner's missing.
Boyle's gun is gone, Sergeant.
Repeat, Lecter's missing hand arm. He stripped the bed. Might be making a rope, check all windows. Where the fuck is my ambulance?
He's alive.
Sergeant Tate, he's alive.
Get a hold of him or you can feel his hands, son. Talk to him.
What do I say?
It's Jim Pembrey now. Talk to him, damn it. Lecter's missing hand arm.
Pembrey, can you hear me?
Took Boyle's gun. Pembrey got off 1 round. There's a chance Lecter was hit.
Keep breathing in and out. That's it. You're doing a good job. Oh, you look real good there. Yeah, you look real good.
Pembrey is lying on his back, his head in a pool of blood. His face is covered in blood. Outside, the sirens wailing, police cars roll up. Armed police are guarding the building. 3 uniformed sharpshooters with high-velocity rifles emerge from a car.
Let's go.
An ambulance team move a stretcher into the courthouse. Bobby is patting Pembrey's hand.
Looking good, Pembrey. You're gonna make it. Everything's just fine. But all right. That's right.
Okay, I need an IV now.
Activated ringers.
Can we get the strap?
Right.
Where's the fucking oxygen?
Looking good, buddy. That's right.
Buzz.
Stay with me. Stay with me here.
We're losing him.
A convulsing Pembrey is wheeled out of the courtroom and brought down in the elevator.
Roger, Lieutenant. Tate here. I'm on the elevator bringing Pembrey down. He seems to be hanging on. Top 3 floors secured. Main stairwell secured. We think he's on 2.
Spots of blood drip onto the unconscious Pembrey stretcher from the ceiling of the elevator. The 3 policemen and 2 medics look up at a blood-soaked hatch, and Sergeant Tate draws his gun.
Are you still with me?
We're pretty sure he's somewhere on 2, sir. That's all for now. Over.
The elevator reaches ground level, and Pembrey is wheeled out by the medics. Tate, his eyes fixed on the hatch, indicates for the 2 other officers to leave. They too cover the hatch. Switching off the elevator, Tate beckons one of the sharpshooters.
It's on the roof of the elevator.
Okay, guys.
I
Two marksmen open the doors on the first level and push in a mirror on a pole. Reflected in it, a blood-stained figure face down on the elevator roof. They look down the shaft.
I see him. There's a gun by his hand. He's not moving.
One warning. We need him alive.
Got him. Lecter, put your hands on your head. One of the leg.
One of the marksmen takes careful aim with a handgun. He hits the back of the right leg above the knee.
Johnny, hold your fire. We're coming into the car.
We're opening the hatch. Watch his hands. If there's any fire, it'll come from us. Affirm.
Got it.
From outside the open elevator, the officer waves his men in with a jerk of his arm. Three men rush into the elevator, one with a handgun and stepladder, the others with rifles. Placing the stepladder to the left of the hatch, the officer with the pistol climbs up and opens the hatch. It falls open on its hinges, and with it, a torso.
Memphis General, this is Medical Unit 26. We're inbound with a 50-year-old male police officer with severe facial lacerations, weapon unknown. We've got grand mal seizure activity, but he's postictal now. The vital signs are good. Pressure is 130 over 90.
90?
Yeah, that's right, 90. Pulse 84. We got him on lactated ringers running, and the patient is on 10 liters of oxygen.
Penbury rises, peeling the bloody skin from his face, revealing Lecter.
They found the ambulance in a parking garage at Memphis Airport. The crew was dead. He killed a tourist, too. Got his clothes, cash. By now, he could be anywhere.
He won't come after me.
Oh, really?
He won't. I can't explain it. He would consider that rude. It's over. She's dead.
It's not your fault it worked out like this.
The thing is that Lecter said everything we need to catch him with is right here in these pages, only I can't...
Dr. Lecter said a lot of things.
He's here, Ardelia.
Clarice picks up the Buffalo Bill file and reopens it. Buffalo Bill himself is sitting in front of a sewing machine, a piece of material in it. Using both hands, he holds the material taut. Its texture is of supple flesh. The full concentration of the naked man is on his work. Meanwhile, Clarice and Ardelia are sitting cross-legged on top of washing machines in the Academy laundry. Ardelia is studying a map.
Clarice, doesn't this random scattering of sight seem desperately random? Like the elaboration of a bad liar, Ty Hannibal Lecter.
Desperately random? What does he mean?
Not random at all, maybe. Like there's some pattern here.
Yeah, but there is no pattern, or the computers would have nailed it. Or even found in random order.
Random because of the one girl. The one he waited down.
Frederica Bimmel.
Right.
From Belvedere, Ohio. First girl taken, third body found. Why?
Well, she didn't drift. He waited her down.
What did Lecter say about the first principles?
Simplicity.
What does this guy do? He covets. How do we first start to covet?
We covet what we see.
Every day.
Hot damn, Clarice.
You knew her.
A steel girder bridge straddling the muddy brown river at Belvedere, Ohio. Clarice drives across it to an industrial town and to a riverside suburb, the winter trees tall and bare. On a street of wooden houses with an air of decaying prosperity, Clarice draws up outside a white two-story detached house, a porch with four steps up in front of it. A freight train passing slowly by, a woman in a heavy jacket hanging out washing on a tiny line, a sparrow on a garden birdhouse, its roof spattered in droppings, a tiny scarecrow in the shape of a red Indian paddling a canoe, a large woman looking down from a half-open upstairs sash window. These are the sights which greet Clarice as she walks round to the back of the house and sees a man in his late 40s holding a pigeon in his hands. She crosses to him.
Mr. Bimmel?
That's me.
Hello, I'm Clarice Starling. I'm with the FBI.
sure appreciate you letting me take a look around, Mr. Bimmel.
I don't know nothing new to tell you. Police been back here so many times already. Frederica went into Chicago on the bus to see about a job. She left the interview okay. She never come home. Her bedroom's how she left it. Upstairs, door to the left.
Upstairs in Frederica's room, Clarice first looks out the window to the house opposite, and from a second window across to the river. Taking off her duffel coat, she notices on the wall a pop poster, and beside it in a frame four photographs of Frederica and Frederica's father. Taking her eyes from the happy, smiling faces, Clarice returns her gaze to the Riverview window. On the ledge, an oval-framed photograph of a young Frederica with her mother. Frederica is holding a black and white cat. Clarice's steely blue eyes now roam around the room again, lighting on a fabric-covered jewel box, which she crosses to. Wedged under the lining in the lid of the musical box, Clarice finds some Polaroid photographs. Studying them, she sees images of the large Frederica, dressed only in her underwear, some with her face covered by her hands. Attracted by the mewing of a cat, Clarice goes to the bedroom door and sees the cat from the photograph, washing itself by another door. Clarice crosses the hallway and follows the large tabby into the bedroom directly opposite Frederica's. From the window she sees Frederica's father gently handling his pigeons. By the window is a dressmaker's dummy, a tape measure flung over the torso. Next to the dummy, a cupboard. The inquisitive Clarice opens it and finds dresses in it. One in particular has two white diamond shapes pinned to the thighs.
He's making himself a woman's suit, Mr. Crawford, out of real women. And he can sew, this guy. He's very skilled. He's a tailor or a dressmaker.
Starling.
That's why they're all so big. He has to keep them alive so he can starve them a while so that he can loosen their skin and take...
Starling, we know who he is and where he is. We're on our way right now.
Where?
Calumet City, edge of Chicago. We'll be on the ground in 45 minutes with HRT.
Oh, that's great news, sir, but how?
Johns Hopkins came up with some names. We fed him into known offenders.
Subject's name is Jamie Gum, a.k.a. John Grant.
Lecter's description is accurate. He just lied about the name. Listen to this.
Customs had some paper on it. They stopped a carton 2 years ago at LAX. Live caterpillars from Suriname. The addressee was a James Gum.
Well, Chicago's only 400 miles from here. I'll be there in...
No, Starling.
There's not enough time. We want him for murder, not kidnapping. I need you to link him to the Bimmel girl before he's indicted. See what you can dredge up in Belvedere.
Yes, sir. You bet. I'll do my best.
Starling.
We wouldn't have found him without you. Nobody's going to forget that.
At least of all me.
Thank you, sir. Thank you very much, Mr. Crawford. Miss Crawford?
Clarice loses contact with Crawford's plane. In the pit in Buffalo Bill's cellar, Catherine is shivering, her hands and face are filthy, her eyes dull.
Thanks for the scraps, asshole. I got a better idea.
Catherine is tying a small bone to a length of cord attached to the blue bucket Buffalo Bill uses to pass food to her. She looks up forlornly to the stone-encircled top of the pit. In the house, Bill holds a tray of eye makeup in his hands. Catherine, meanwhile, is ready to hurl the bucket.
Got precious time for a little treat.
bucket has landed on the floor of the cellar. Precious, his little white poodle, hears it landing, but Bill is too busy applying eyeshadow.
Precious! Come on, girl! Come on, Precious! Come on, Precious!
Painted on Bill's body, a design of black lines with red droplets.
Come on, Precious! I got a yummy, yummy snack for ya! Come on, come and get it!
As Precious responds to the cries, Bill fondles the ring through his nipple.
Precious! Are you up there, you little shit? Come and get it, pretty girl!
Precious is now in the sand-floored cellar. Bill puts on a glass necklet.
Precious! Please come, come on!
With his stained fingers, Bill puts a long chain charm round his neck. Bill brushes on lipstick, and Precious stands at the pit edge.
Will you fuck me?
Come on, come on, come on, come on, come on, come on.
The bucket trap fails.
I'd fuck myself.
No.
His makeup fully applied and a long scalped wig covering his head, Bill turns on a video and dances grotesquely in front of it. While Catherine weeps in the pit, Bill continues his gyrations in front of camera. Squeezing his male organs between his tightly closed legs, he reveals himself to the camera as the female he wants to be. Naked, apart from blue stockings and a multicolored cape opened up by his outstretched hands, he stands and poses for himself. Crawford is now at Air National Guard headquarters in Chicago. Therese, meanwhile, is continuing her investigations in Belvedere, interviewing one of Frederica's friends at work in an ice cream bar.
Good job, FBI agent. You get to travel around and stuff. I mean, better places than this.
Sometimes you do.
Freddie was so happy for me when I got this job at the bank. Toaster giveaways and Barry Manilow on the speakers all day. She thought it was such hot shit. What did she know, big dummy?
Stacy, did Frederica ever mention a man named Jamie Gum or a James Gum? How about John Grant?
No.
Oh, would she have had a friend that you didn't know about or?
No way. She had a guy I'd have known, believe me. Sewing was her life.
Did you two ever work together? Or?
Oh, sure. Me and Pam Malavasi used to help her do alterations for old Mrs. Littman.
Can you give me Mrs. Littman's address? I need to talk to her.
The exterior of a detached bungalow in a leafy suburb of Calumet City, Illinois. Now Bill is with his bugs and chrysalis. He picks up one of the writhing insects, puts a hand at each end of the inch-long grub, and teases it from its cocoon. Armed troops arrive at the Calumet City bungalow. Meanwhile, the grub is crawling on Bill's nose. More troops creep up on the bungalow. Bill follows the yelps to the cellar, and troops now surround the bungalow.
Down here, you sack of shit!
Catherine has the dog in the pit. Crawford arrives at the bungalow. Bill, meanwhile, lowers a light into the pit.
Now you give me a telephone and lower it down here, now!
Poorly, Precious. Darling, how are you all right?
She's in a lot of pain, mister. She needs a vet.
A florist's van draws up, providing cover for Crawford.
I know it. She's been licking.
Hey, don't you hurt my dog!
Don't you make me hurt your dog!
Hey, you don't know what pain is!
The florist takes a box from the van. Bill is now frantically pacing the cellar. The florist walks up the path to the front door.
I'm gonna do it, mister!
A demented Bill picks up a handgun. Meanwhile, Crawford watches as the delivery boy reaches the bungalow door. Bill glances up at the old electric bell system. Crawford indicates to the delivery boy.
Hey, I'm coming.
We're going in.
The troops rush the bungalow as Bill opens his door.
Good afternoon. Sorry to bother you. I'm looking for Mrs. Lippman's family.
Everybody down!
No, Lippmans don't live here anymore.
Excuse me, sir. I really need to speak with you.
Clear! Clear! What's the problem, officer?
Well, I'm investigating the death of Frederica Bimmel.
The troops are in another house altogether.
Clarice?
Your name is?
Jack Gordon.
Mr. Gordon. Good. Well, Frederica used to work for Mrs. Lippman. Did you know her?
No, uh-uh. Oh, wait. Was she a great big fat person?
Yeah, she was a big girl, sir.
Yeah, I read about her in the newspaper. Mrs. Lippman had a son, though. Maybe he could help you. I got his card in here someplace. So do you want to come in while I look for it?
May I?
Yes, sir.
Thank you.
The bare trees by the river. The railway tracks. The wooden two-story buildings in the background. Clarice's car parked by the railway line outside another detached house. She's still in Belvedere. Clarice slowly wanders through the gloomy house.
Yes, we may be. Did you take over this place after Mrs. Lippman died, is that right?
Yeah, I bought this house 2 years ago.
Did she leave any records, any business records, tax forms, list of employees?
No, nothing like that at all. Say, has the FBI learned something? The police around here don't seem to have the first clue.
The house is untidy. As Bill looks through cards, Clarice spots a moth landing on bobbins. Slowly, realization dawns.
Descriptions, fingerprints, anything like that?
No. No.
Clarice stealthily unfastens her gun holster and takes off the safety catch. Bill is by the kitchen, on top of the filthy stove, his pistol.
Here's that number.
Very good, Mr. Gordon. May I use your phone, please?
You can use my phone.
Freeze! Put your hands over your head and turn around. Spread your legs. Put your hands in the back. Thumbs up. Freeze!
Bill has slipped through the kitchen doorway. Clarice follows him through. Taking off her coat, she goes to a door. Holding her gun in both hands, her arms straight out in front of her, Clarice stands in the cellar doorway. Squatting down on her haunches, she starts to make her way cautiously down the cellar steps, swinging the gun from side to side in front of her. She sees a dirt-covered old washing machine and fridge, and two closed doors. Almost crawling down the stairs, she straightens up and pauses at a turn, leaning against the junction of two brick walls. She walks towards one of the doors, her hands and head still, her eyes fixed on the second door. Through the door, Clarice's alert eyes focus on a long brick corridor.
Thank you.
through another door, a room with photos of girls on the wall, and on a dummy, a dress of skin. Attracted by the cries and the dogs yelping, Clarice heads for another door. Bursting through it, she enters that part of the cellar where the pit is situated.
FBI! You're safe!
Safe! Get me out of here!
Securing the door she's just come through with a spade, Clarice checks out another.
You're all right, Catherine. Now, where is he?
How the fuck should I know? Just get me out of here!
Catherine, you gotta be quiet. Now, shut that dog up!
Just get me out of here!
Catherine, I'm gonna get you out of there, but right now, you listen to me. I've gotta leave this room. I'll be right back.
No! Don't you leave me here, you fucking bitch! No! Don't you leave me here! This guy's fucking crazy! Please! I gotta get out of here!
Please. Catherine! The other officers will be here any minute now!
Wait! Don't go! Please!
Quiet!
Oh, God.
One door is locked. One door she secured. So Clarice goes through a third. Moths are buzzing around a grimy corridor leading to the room with an aquarium and the cases of butterflies and pupae. Spinning on hearing a noise, Clarice sees only a Nazi poster pinned to the door but no sign of a quarry. She begins to back her way out towards the door by which she entered, her head moving all the while, her face covered in sweat. In the corridor, she edges her way along back to the wall till she comes to yet another door. Biting her lower lip, she pushes the door ajar. She sees a putrefying body in a bath as the lights are turned out. In pitch black, she fumbles her way out of the bathroom. Bill is wearing his infrared night sight glasses and sees her every move. Unaware of his presence, she feels her way along the wall, knocking into screens and cupboards which she cannot see. Bill starts moving slowly towards Clarice. He sees her frightened face, her wide-open eyes desperately trying to see in the dark. Her gun is pointed at him, though she doesn't know it. Turning, she stumbles. Bill follows her into the room where he keeps his dressmaking models and watches her brush against them. Keeping her gun in her right hand close to her chest, she stretches out her left hand in front of her to feel her way. Her back is to him, his hand moves out to almost touch her hair. As if sensing his presence, she spins round. Now he moves his hand towards her face, only inches from her mouth and nose, and she is unaware of it. Her back to him again, she moves away towards the sewing machine. Bill follows a little way, then raises his gun and releases the catch. Clarice spun round, gun blazing on hearing the catch being released. Bill is writhing on the floor on his back, blood soaking his chest. In the exchange of fire, a stray bullet broke a shuttered window and light streams in. By it, she sees blood spray from Bill's mouth in his dying gasp. Moving over to him, she kicks away his gun, her own replenished weapon still pointing at him. He lies there, the weird binocular-type glasses still strapped over his eyes, blood trickling from his mouth, and a big red stain on his chest. She sees the press cuttings, and by the broken window, a soldier's helmet. A butterfly fan twirls in the breeze. Crawford and his men have arrived in Belvedere. Catherine, clutching Precious to her, is helped towards a waiting ambulance by two orange-coated medics. Crawford puts his arm round Clarice as she walks down the porch steps.
You okay? Gunpowder, it's nothing.
Agent Starling, how did you track Buffalo Bill to this address?
The FBI Academy graduation ceremony.
Clarice M. Starling.
Congratulations.
Ardelia gives Clarice a thumbs up, then Clarice smiles at Crawford, standing apart, applauding her.
W. Stevens.
Crawford looks at his watch, then goes out of the hall. A huge celebration cake, decorated in the style of the insignia of the FBI, is cut at the reception. Clarice is standing with Crawford and the two insect experts when Ardelia interrupts.
Special Agent Man? Phone call. Excuse me, John.
Starling? Hilch, did you take our picture?
Sure. Look, I just wanted to say congratulations. And I'm not much good at this kind of thing, so I'm going to duck out of here.
Okay, sure. Thank you, Mr. Crawford.
He shakes her proffered hand.
My father would have been proud today. Don't forget your phone call.
She watches him leave the reception, then goes to the phone.
Well, Clarice, have the lambs stopped screaming?
Louder, louder.
Don't bother with the trace. I won't be on long enough.
Where are you, Dr. Lecter?
I have no plans to call on you, Clarice. The world's more interesting with you in it. So you take care now to extend me the same courtesy.
You know I can't make that promise.
I do wish we could chat longer, but I'm having an old friend for dinner. Bye.
Dr. Lecter. Dr. Lecter. Dr. Lecter.
Bring it. Oh, excuse me. I'm sorry. You have the security system all set up.
We have the big shots in here.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
Hannibal Lecter is sitting in a bar in the Bahamas, placing a brown Panama hat over his long blonde wig and wearing a light tropical suit. Hannibal rises and walks along the crowded, bustling street, following his old friend, Dr. Frederick Chilton. ITFC audio description was by James O'Hara.